thanks for coming. It's my great pleasure to welcome Professor Tony Stewart, who is the Gertrude Conway Vanderbilt Chair in the Humanities. And we're very lucky to have Tony, I think. He's the world's foremost expert in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. And he's got many publications to his name, but in particular, the book that I read only recently, within 6 months, was a book called The Last Word.
Final Word.
I'm so sorry. I should have read it years ago, but I just got around to it.
It's a
fantastic book. You must all read it. It's a seriously important book because Tony shows that with Chaitanya, it's like we've gone into a new world. It's like goodbye tantric sacrifice, goodbye state-sponsored religion, and that. We're in this new realm with this text, with Chaitanya Charitamrita. And I thought it was so important and so striking that he's sketching out this new phase in the development of Indian thinking and Indian practice as well. Of course, Chaitanya, he's a contemporary of Shiromani, who's that philosopher in Navadvip. He's a contemporary of Guru Nanak, another big thing going on up there, and he's a contemporary of Martin Luther, on a completely different continent. So anyway, I got really excited reading this book, so I would encourage you all to read it while Tony's here, and you can ask him questions about it. And then since then, he's gone into another world, opened up another world of a Vaishnava-Sufi interface, which is really interesting. And makes us question these categories of Hinduism, Islam, Vaishnavism, Sufism, and so on. And Batwoman, by the look of it, too. And today he's going to talk to us with the lecture entitled Challenging Expectations, Interpreting the Bengali Satya Naringar Puti of Kavi Vallabh.
Yeah, Narayana. Satya Narayana.
Sorry, Satya Narayana.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's my writing, I can't remember. Tony, over to you.
Well, thank you very much. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but, about some of my accomplishments, but that's very nice of you to say. This is a woman who's become my sort of tutelary gurvi. She's the guardian of those of us who have moved on out of the academy and are retired from teaching. And she's in Vanderbilt colors, actually, which you see right there. So anyway, I want to talk today about Shaktapeer and Shaktanarayan. And this Shaktadevar Panchali starts with this little, I will appear in the form of Shakto to dispel untruth, Ashakto. Unrighteous people will bear the brunt of my appearance when I manifest myself in the form of Satyapeer. So the literature, when I was doing my dissertation research in 81 and 82, I was there for about a year and a half in Calcutta, and I started, I kept in the bookstalls and, all kinds of places, I kept running into this strange figure, Satyapeer. And Shaktapeer, Shaktanarayan, and I couldn't figure out what the relation was. And then I finally discovered that they're one and the same. As I started digging around, anything that was printed, I would snatch it up. And after a couple of years, I was looking through my files, and I realized I had 1.5 file cabinet drawers full of material on Shaktapeer. And at the same time, when I started, everywhere I was searching, I found less than 80 pages of secondary literature dedicated to Shaktapeer. And most of it was simply repeating what everybody else had said was, he's Satyanarayan, he's Satyapeer. And they really had no insights whatsoever. So then I really started a systematic search, and I found there were more than 700 extant manuscripts, 750. There's more than 200 print editions of the Shaktapeer Sahitya by more than 100 different authors. So it made me, I decided at that point, this was the late 80s, that I would start pursuing this sort of in extenso. And then I went to Dhaka a few years later and spent a couple of years digging around in the manuscripts and working on the material. The earliest texts that we have are from the 16th century. There's some suggestion, by the way these extant manuscripts are, the copyists would indicate that maybe it was a little earlier, but this probably is just pre or contemporary to Chaitanya. And surprisingly, these four authors, we have more than a few manuscripts. This is not just a, like a one-off work, but rather several copies for each one. And this material is really provides the initial material that I worked with, but I translated a whole bunch of the stories in Fabulous Females and Peerless Peers, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. But this was the first, and I had already had a couple of small publications, translations as well as analyses before I published this, but I show that because then you can find a kind of treasure trove there. The initial impulse of this community, or this literature, I should say, it's not a community so, per se, is one where, you know, Boishnavs, and not only Boishnavs, are saying that the Mushalmans are, you know, responsible for the the sort of destruction of the Kali Age, where everything is falling apart. And this literature sort of gently suggests that they've got it backwards, that Peers, Fakirs, Puranis, Bibis, all of these figures are actually providing the answer to the ills of the Kali Age, not being responsible for it. And they provide solutions that offer, on the whole, a kind of equitable alternative that made life in this world and salvation for the next available to everyone, regardless of gender, ethnic background, or social rank, or religious affiliation. It was anyone can turn to Chateaupierre and benefit. There are three implotments or narrative codes that I found when I started looking at all of the literature together, and I read about 150 of the manuscripts. Almost all of them, probably 95% of them were complete, and most of them were dated. So I was able to get a real good sense, and then of course with all the print literature as well, and I've got copies. When I said there's more than, 200 print, I've got about 170 of them that I've physically handled and read. I realized that there were sort of three implotments for these texts. The earliest is the Boishnav orientation noted above, the avatar, the Jug avatar. And so there is and that's the largest body of literature. The second implotment comes a little bit later, and I've just styled it. I don't know what to call it, quite frankly, but it's really gendered creativity. It's almost all about women and how women who are put upon by the men around them, and then how they have to respond and use their own wits to sort of recenter the world. And then finally, there is a little later a Mushalmani orientation, which is starts to change the tenor a little bit. So they develop diachronically, but they don't constitute, and I really want to underscore this, this is not constituting a linear teleology, but rather all three are still being consumed and produced. And the latest stuff that I've seen is actually only a few decades old. So they really document the range of possibilities in a Bengali-conditioned world, and they explore what I would say subjunctively what might be a different configuration of that world. So they're not satisfied with the way things are, and they're suggesting alternatives. What I'm going to talk to you about today in the introduction is actually in Chapter 6 of Witness to Marvels, And if you don't already have it, you can download it for free through open access at the University of California Press. And it's a PDF. They printed the book from the PDF, so it's identical in every way. And I think you'll get a lot more and a lot more sophisticated analysis than what I'm able to deliver orally. The Vaishnava implotment is really sort of traditional Indic or Hinduani avatar of the age. The original stories seem to come out of the Skanda Purana and Bhavisha Purana, and as you probably are aware, those are not terribly old as Puranas go. And there's a cycle of three tales in those Puranas, to which a fourth tale is sometimes added, but very rarely. These tales often then become the source for brats and pujas, and so you'll find Shatopir, Shatanarayan brats in like Meder Bratkatha, you know, those little handbooks that people do the family or domestic observances. The three stories that are most common, well, they all start with the Doridra Brahman, the poor Brahman. And the Brahman is so poor, you know, how poor is he? Well, he's so poor that he's in Benares, where, you know, anybody can collect alms. And he can't even get by with the alms that he collects in Benares. So what does he do? Well, he does what any good Bengali Brahmin does when they're broke, is they go to Bengal. They go to East Bengal. Chaitanya did this, by the way. I don't know if you remember. When they needed money for the family, he took off to East Bengal. But seriously, because most of Bengal, the population was lying, a lot of it was lying to the east of the river, then traditionally, that takes you out of Madhyadesh. And so the Brahmins couldn't cross into that region. And so Brahmins in that region were rare, and which is why it was easy money, I guess you could say. So he goes to Bengal, and he's on the edge of the road begging, and Shatopir shows up. And Shatopir says, you know, what's wrong? And the guy's complaining, you know, I can't get by. My wife and I are basically starving to death. And he says, well, if you will simply make an offering of Shinni or Shirmni, both pronunciations and about eight different spellings are common, which is a little mixture of rice flour, milk, a banana, you know, if you'll just do that, and it's an aniconic worship, you don't have to have anything to do it, you just offer it with heartfelt devotion, and you'll get rich. And this Brahmin says, you know, well, that's all well and good, but I'm a Vaishnava, and I cannot possibly make an offering to a fakir or peer. So, you know, just don't even ask. And he says, well, I don't think you understand. And he said, I can only make my offerings to Narayan. So Shatopir looks at him for a second, and he said, now look closely. And he goes, ring, you know, and he springs arms and shows himself to be Narayan. And then he transforms into Krishna. In some stories, he transforms into Krishna. The Brahmin is convinced. Believes his eyes, which is interesting, and makes the offering, and lo and behold, in no time at all, he's really wealthy. Well, the local woodcutters, were constantly every day tramping up and down this road, and then suddenly, you know, one day they see that this Brahmin now has lots of money, and they're trying to figure out what on earth, the woodcutters stopped and said, how did this happen? And he explained to them that it was Shatopir. Then Shatopir had told him, when anyone asks, you have to tell them the secret of how you got wealthy. And so he shares it with the woodcutters, and the woodcutters have no hesitation whatsoever. They all make their offerings of Shirni, And the next thing you know, they're living in a big palace, you know, so it worked yet again. And then finally, there's the seafaring merchant who the king, you know, kings always need stuff, and the kings need, you know, fly whisks and things like that. So they send these guys out, and they go down the coast and, you know, out of Bengal, down the coast of India, and they trade. And then, you know, ideally they come back and they get wealthy. But in fact, what happens is inevitably either the merchants are lazy or forgetful, and they'd contracted with Chateaupeer to protect them and to help them get wealthy. And so they forget to offer the puja, the shirni. Or in some cases, several of the stories, the merchants get all the way, or after several ordeals where Chateaupeer tests them, they get home. And as they're sailing right into the home port, their wives or a daughter-in-law fails to make the offering, or drops it and steps on it, or, you know, there's always some mess up, and the boats all sink instantly. And then only after the amends are made that they're brought back. And then finally, out of the hundreds of texts, there's only a couple that have this Bangsho Daj and Tunga Daj stories. They're kings who are, you know, chasing wild animals, you know, out in the jungle, and they run across these guys who are tending their cattle, and they say, you need to, you know, make an offering, and the kings just say, no way, I'm not going to do that. I don't make offerings to anybody, you know, I mean, that kind of thing. And so immediately the kings own all the animals in the kingdom, you know, are dying and this kind of thing until they wake up, and then they take steps. It's a super truncated story. It's tacked on, and it, like I said, it almost never appears. Now, what do all these things have in common, all these tales? If you worship Chateaupeer, you get rich. Penury is the root of all moral problems in the world. Someone who is so hungry that they simply can barely move is not going to be a very good person. They're not going to have any kind of moral standard. And Chateaupeer repeatedly says this is the underlying religious act, basically, is you know, working to making this offering gives you the money, which puts you in a position to make morally correct decisions, dharmically correct decisions. And so, you know, he argues that if you're poor, asking somebody to be moral or to be religious is actually naive, if not just downright stupid, because it can't happen, you know, if you don't have any money at all. So it really, it's a very interesting take on the entrepreneurial world of Bengal, I think. But it's also a recognition of the importance of sort of the economic foundation of all, you know, religious traditions, basically. At least I think that's what it is. So, anyway, the second implotment, which I've called gendered creativity, is mainly about resourceful women. Chateaupeer's interventions depend on the personal commitment of the heroine, and occasionally a hero, to improvise ways to align personal action with a dharmically defined moral order, to exhibit patience in the face of seemingly intractable problems, and to exhibit a gritty determination to succeed, only turning to Chateaupeer when the woman has exhausted all of her personal resources. Chateaupeer doesn't come in and save the woman. Rather, the woman takes the action, and when she needs help, she'll ask for it. And one heartfelt call can summon Shatopir from ethereal Mecca or Behesht, paradise, where he hangs out. And he'll materialize in an instant and aid. Now, he doesn't solve the woman's problems in any of these, but rather he helps them gives them a wherewithal to do it on their own. And these are, and give you one example out of this, and I've translated this in Fabulous Females and Peerless Peers, is the story of Laomun. And Laomun is raised as a boy, goes to school, and the king's, the prince, was good friends with him. And then one day he saw her up in the balcony combing out her hair and realized it was a woman. And so he's immediately smitten, and he sort of throws himself on her. And she says, "Look, we're not doing anything until we are, somebody witnesses our commitment and marriage." And he says, "No, we can't wait." And she says, so she calls on Shatopir, and Shatopir materializes instantly. And it really angers this guy named Hussein. And Hussein picks up a qalam, a pen, and hurls it at Shatopir, which is not a real smart thing to do. And Shatopir immediately curses him to lose his head. So, not immediately, but he will. And so the king finds out what's transpired and is furious. And so even though the woman is the daughter of his primary minister, so they both dress as sepoys, and they go out and they steal horses from the stable, and they run out, and then they're attacked by these various dacoits, and they fight back to back, and beautiful descriptions of this back to back fighting where they're hacking away and protecting one another. And then they prevail, and they're finishing off the people who had attacked them. And one of them, the little boy who was a servant of one of the dacoits, Hussein very stupidly says, "Oh, let's not kill him, just let's keep him, we'll need him, he'll be useful." And so, of course, as soon as they go to sleep, the boy whacks off Hussein's head. And then Hussein, now headless, Laomun picks up his head, cradles it in her lap, and starts to mourn. And all the animals in the forest suddenly realize what's going on, and they stop. They stop everything they're doing. And she's referred to as Behula. Which, as most of you know, is the quintessential savior of a dead husband. Mm-hmm. not only because of her devotion, but the whole animal kingdom has basically awakened Shatopir from his ethereal perch. And so he comes down and he reattaches the head of Hussein. And everybody's happy, and they run off. Well, they only go for a day or two, and then Hussein decides to go into town to try and find some food. And so as he's going in, a garland weaver, Amalani, spots him, and she realizes he's a prince. And so she fixes her hair, and she sort of looks down and makes sure that she's very, her body is very visible to Hussein as he comes up, and he says, "I would like some flowers." And she says, "Oh, I've got just the garland for you." And she leans over real far, and she puts the garland over his head. Bam! He's transmogrified into a ram. And so she keeps him as a ram by day, and then turns him back into a prince at night, and uses him for breeding stock, as it were. But when she turns him back into a man, he's mute. So she she's got him captive. So he grazes outside during the day, and then at night he's in the bedroom. And then, so finally, Laomon realizes that this is he's not coming back again. So she goes off, and Mi is immediately arrested for having these royal horses, which are obviously royal, and she's thrown in jail. Well, it turns out there's a white rhino. Are you ready for this? There's a white rhino that is laying waste to the kingdom, and she hears about it in the jail, and so she and the king has offered a reward. If you can kill this rhino, you'll get half my kingdom and the hand of my daughter in marriage. So Laomon bribes her way out, and why she didn't do this earlier is not clear, but she bribes her way out of jail, and she's still in drag. And so she goes out and she slays this white rhino, and she cuts off its horn and its tongue. And a lot of other people try to pretend that they did it, but she had the horn and the tongue, so the king knew. And so the king, as promised, gives her half of his kingdom, and he gives her in marriage to his daughter. And Laomon goes along with it. And so now Laomon is married to the daughter of the king. And she won't consummate the marriage. And so weeks passed, and this bride is beside herself, wondering what's wrong. And then finally, Laomon tells her what it is. And she goes to her father, and you can just see this, Daddy, do you have any idea what you've just done? And that's the way it reads. It's like one of these almost comical. And so the king is a little bit nonplussed, and eventually they find out where Hussein is. They manage to get him turned back into a human. They slay the woman who had ensorcelled him.